Volám sa Katarína Stríčková a teším sa, že v rámci podcastov denníka N počúvate môj podcast V ženskom rode, ktorý tvoria rozhovory s inšpiratívnymi ženami. V ženskom rode sú totiž v slovenčine tie najsilnejšie slová: dôvera, pravda, spoľahlivosť, odvaha, múdrosť či pokora. Ale aj zrada, pýcha, nevera, závisť, prehra či smrť. Osobne som presvedčená, že nad nimi všetkými stoja láska a nádej. Nech vás naplňajú po každom vypočutom rozhovore. In Feminine Gender Podcast is a platform that gives women opportunity to tell their story. Women can speak freely and openly about their experience. They share their lives and memories. They offer their thoughts, ideas and visions and inspire both women and men. Today I speak with Carolee Winstein, professor of biokinesiology at the University of Southern California, and Larissa Ann Thorne, a neutrino physicist and postdoctoral researcher on the Project 8 experiment, during their visit to Slovakia on the occasion of ESET Science Award 2021. Welcome in the studio of Denník N and V ženskom rode podcast, which means in feminine gender in English.
Well, thank you for having us.
Yes.
This is a fantastic opportunity.
Very much. Very
happy. I must admit that it was a challenge, very big challenge for me, because it's not very usual to have a world-known scientist in the studio. And it's not easy to read about neutrinos and all other stuff. And I was thinking how to actually approach this topic, because I think that I am biased. When I was in my early school years, I loved biology and chemistry. I very much loved it. And then I got a new teacher, and she was very tough. And she preferred boys in a sense that she really cheered them on. She really supported all boys. But, and it was a paradox because she was a woman, she somehow did not very much like when girls were too curious. Mm-hmm. And I think that curiosity is a basic prerequisition of learning. Mm-hmm. You need to be curious and ask questions to start learning. So my first question would be, what or who was your first mentor or teacher or tutor, maybe a parent, and you know who I have in mind in your case, mm-hmm. Who opened up your eyes and mind and getting curious about life and maybe science, mm-hmm. Carolee?
Well, I grew up in an academic family. Well, my father was a chemist. My mother was a art patron. And so I had sort of right, left brain, you know, upbringing. And I think it was the environment and the fact that, so I had an older brother. Mm-hmm. And my parents never sort of indicated that my brother would go further than I would. It was always, you know, you can do whatever you want to do. And the sky is yours. And find something that you're passionate about and you'll succeed. So I think being in an academic environment, I was sort of moved in that direction.
What was so attractive? Because, you know, I mean, if my mother would be art patron and my father a chemist, I'm not really sure what would be the force pulling me towards
right.
that or the other direction. I know that your father died
very
early,
yes.
very young,
yes.
basically on the peak of his
yes.
scientific career.
Yes. And you know, my mother's influence on me in terms of appreciating art, I carry that with me to this day. I notice things. I, you know, and there's some beauty in aesthetic beauty in art. But I think the, you know, discovering how things work, why things work the way they work, is what attracted me to sort of the academic side. And it wasn't chemistry that I became interested in. It was physiology and sort of how the body worked. And, you know, and that's what I think got me on the path that I was on. But when my father died, it was really devastating to our family. It was just, my mother just, she just sort of fell apart. And her whole life had been sort of around my father. And I sort of at that moment said, this is not going to happen to me. I'm not going to be, you know, dependent on a man for my existence. And so I kind of went in the other direction. And I said, you know, I'm going to have a career. I'm ambitious. This is what I want. And that's essentially what happened. And I don't know if that would have happened. My father died when I was 19. And so I was young and still at university. And I was at the university where he was a professor. And, and everybody was, how are you? Are you handling things? You know, it was.
So you jumped right in.
I was already very passionate about my studies and what I was doing as an undergraduate. And I had a fantastic mentor in physiology. She was amazing woman. And I just gravitated toward that. And I was having success in it. I was loving it. And I just decided at that point that, you know, I would either apply to graduate school or to become sort of independent, have my own income, I would apply to physical therapy school and become a physical therapist.
Let me ask you a question about expectations of society. Because on one hand, you have family and you have support in your parents or maybe tutors and mentors and teachers who know you. But at the time when you were growing up, the expectations of society, of what a woman, what is the role of a woman, was not that easy.
No.
It wasn't very much so that every woman would, want to have a career.
Correct.
How did you perceive that? Was it easy or how difficult it was if it wasn't?
So I guess I was somewhat protected from that in the environment that I was in, you know, my family.
You had your niche, yeah?
Yeah, I had my niche. But I did become aware of, friends of mine who were in environments where, the expectations for women were much lower than men. And they just decided, they made career choices based on the fact that they felt it would be very tough for them to pursue an academic career or a career, that was primarily dominated by men. And I think this is more so in, the physical sciences than in the medical sciences. But there was an expectation. You could see, people were, what courses did they take? They wanted to take courses that they were expected to succeed in, not the tough ones.
Which, for example?
Yeah.
Languages, so, history?
Yeah, languages, literature, psychology.
How tough it is now, if we jump in time, Larissa, you are actually in really the science, which is, sorry to say, like science. To be honest, I tried to read a couple of articles, both in Slovak, and then I realized, you will conduct it in English, so you need to know how to be said in English. So I really did try, but then I decided not to try.
That's fine.
How tough it is now being a young woman in 21st century? Is there a big difference? Or still are you facing any sort of stereotypes and maybe prejudices that you are a young woman? aspiring for a successful career in physics, astronomy maybe?
Physics, yes.
So what do you think, if you listen to what Carol is saying, how do you compare it with your experience?
So I'm a physicist. I recently finished graduate school. I defended and got my PhD just a few months ago, actually, in June.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And now I've moved on to the next step in this process in academia. I'm in a postdoctoral research position, which will maybe eventually lead to a professorship. So that's where I am in my career. As I said, I'm in physics. And have I faced any sort of prejudices in my life being a woman in this field that's always sort of been considered a hard science?
Exactly.
I would say yes. I would say that I have, you know, maybe I've been treated a bit differently. I certainly have other friends who are females in the physics community who have also had experiences that are a bit worse. But I've been generally pretty lucky with my choice of mentors and my particular path. And I think what's made me a bit more successful and a bit lucky is actually, rather than focusing my efforts on a particular kind of physics, I actually chose one that had a mentor. I picked first the mentor that I thought would be more appropriate for me. Mm-hmm. So I had this teacher in the first year of graduate school, and I felt like we could communicate very well. I felt like I could learn from him. And I also noticed that he had a lot of other female graduate students. So I actually gravitated towards his group, not because I was primarily interested in the physics that he was doing, but because I knew that there were other women who had found success in his group.
So there was a feeling that a success is something which can come in that group for a woman as well.
Yes,
right?
Yes, mm-hmm. Yeah. And it wasn't what I had originally thought I wanted to do in graduate school. I went there and I thought, okay, astrophysics is wonderful. I've always had interests in cosmology, and I've done research in undergraduate in that field, and I thought I wanted to continue in that path. However, when I saw that this professor, who is a male, was doing a nuclear physics program, I thought, okay, I'll give it a chance. It's maybe not my first choice, but I knew that we could connect on the mentoring level, and I kind of made that a priority over the topic of choice. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's one thing that's made me a bit more successful than others, unfortunately, just prioritizing the relationship with your mentor over the topic of of physics.
Well, it only leads me to the same point where I started, that teachers, mentors, and parents and the support girls get from the environment often serves them better, or it's the only thing that can actually lead them to science. It took us about 13 minutes to get to a point where I can ask you a question about Kip Thorne.
A new record.
Right.
I managed to avoid this question because, to be honest, this was actually the moment I became very interested in getting you in the studio. Well, all due respect to him, I was a bit angry when I heard about third time someone telling me, oh, she is a wife off. She is a da-da-da-da off. Do you feel it this way, or is it my bias and my prejudice that I don't like when women are somehow explained by men? Do you need to be explained by men?
So, first of all, Kip never does that.
Obviously, I knew because I saw it when I saw you in a couple of videos together and so on. But I'm talking about other people using this.
And other people do. When he and I got married, I have an aunt who refused to accept the fact that I did not take his name. And she still refers to me as, you know, Carol Lee Thorne.
Or Mrs. Thorne.
Yeah. And it's just not in her repertoire. And I decided, you know, look, this is her world. And I'm not, you know, that's not my who I am, but it you know, it doesn't bother me that she is not accepting this. And, you know, so people are, you know, they have their own sort of preferences. And so I don't get upset by that, but it tells me something about where they're coming from and what they value and what they feel like, you know, my role is.
What do you think that women must do? Because my experience also in this podcast, I've interviewed more than 160 women now. And my experience from what they said was always that they need to work twice as hard, maybe even more, and explain and you know, just be or try to be present and full of themselves, really, like hold themselves mm-hmm. just to somehow be able to stand and face the world and others.
Mm-hmm.
How difficult or easy it was for you in life and maybe, obviously in science. I mean, what I want to hear for others to listen to is that what it takes to have the courage to fight for myself as a woman.
Mm-hmm. It takes a lot of courage, but it takes a lot of confidence too. And I mean, I'm not in the same field as Kip, so I don't have, you know, I have my own professional colleagues who know me as me. And some of them don't even know that, you know, Kip is my husband. Some do. And those that do, you know, they sort of look at us as individuals. We happen to be together. I'm sure there are people out there that look at me and go, oh, you know, she's the wife. And, you know, I even joke about that, you know. I mean, that's my name, you know. And are not aware of my profession and what I do. And
why did you take or keep your name?
For that very reason, that, you know, I mean, I had a career already, you know, and I was known as Carol Lee Winstein. And so, and Kip, in fact, did not want me to take his name. And he didn't want to take my name.
Wow.
So we had this discussion.
Oh, really? So you had this discussion.
Oh, yeah, we had this discussion, and we decided, you know, that was not going to be an issue. And, you know, now it's sort of become standard. When we got married in, you know, 83, it was not 84.
Mm-hmm.
We met in 83. We got married in 84. People were starting to, you know, do these double-barreled names and, you know, and in some cultures, you know, they don't take, you know, their husband's name. In fact, it's not allowed, you know.
Very unusual in Slovakia. It's quite usual and traditional that after marriage, you become, you take the name of your husband.
Yeah.
And that's very traditional. And it's perceived very rare and even like rebellious if you don't take the name of your husband.
Yeah.
But it happens. With modern marriages, it does happen.
Mm-hmm.
Was it difficult for you to, if people knew that you were related to Kip Thorne, the legend.
Yeah.
Was it difficult at school, maybe, or with your peers, that to have that sort of persona behind you?
Just to answer the question directly, yes. It was a little bit less of a not issue, but it was less of a point when I was younger, right? First of all, I was not in an environment that was purely physics community. It was very varied. And secondly, my grandfather hadn't won the Nobel Prize yet. So he was still, you know, while still enormously successful in his own field, he didn't have that international recognition that, you know, makes him somewhat of a household name. But when he was awarded the Nobel Prize, I became a little bit more selective about whom I shared this information with.
Mm-hmm.
Because my primary fear was that people would make the connection between mm-hmm. me as a physicist and my grandfather as a physicist, and maybe that would lead to using me as a way to get to him or creating some sort of expectation on what my ability would be.
That's what
based on what he has done. Exactly. Yeah. And it's not that I feared that I couldn't fill shoes or that I couldn't live up to this. It's just I want to be a physicist in my own right. Now, when I introduce myself to people this week, many wonderful people I've met, I'm not, hello, I'm Kip's granddaughter. I am, hello, I am a neutrino physicist. Nice to meet you. Yeah, I feel like I'm trying to build my own identity separate from my grandfather. Mm-hmm. And it becomes a little bit strange sometimes because it's a secret, and then someone else, someone asks me directly, hey, are you related? Your last name is not very common, you know, mm-hmm. is there a relationship? And then I have to say yes, you know, of course. And it becomes a little bit awkward sometimes because they think I am ashamed of this, connection to him, but that's not the case. I want to be known for me.
This was exactly why I was asking this question, mm-hmm. because for a woman to be herself, it's not easy, even without a famous and rightly famous personality. I mm-hmm. want to say that I respect mm-hmm. him very much. Although I must say that I really did not like Interstellar that much because I was not able to understand every single thing in the movie. quite honestly. In your family, when you meet together for Thanksgiving, let's say, what do you talk about? Are you talking science all the time?
I would say no.
No.
We
talk about. So it's not like, oh, come on, let's talk about neutrinos today.
Well, we talk about what each of us has been doing because we don't live in the same place. And so we catch up on what's going on.
Yeah.
What's going on with the rest of the family? Yeah. You know, what are you doing? How are you, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, we got together on Zoom because of COVID.
Yeah.
And that was weird, but, you know, at
for
least.
For many families,
yeah.
really.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And, but you and your mom came up before we left for Gold Beach.
Yeah.
And it was like April or something.
It was June 2020.
June.
I'd just driven across the country
to
see you all.
That's right. So they drove up from San Diego to mm-hmm. our place in Pasadena, and we had a nice lunch out on the patio. You know, we were like wearing masks, and then we would take our masks off to eat, and we were distanced. You know, we had a table over here. You and your mom were sitting at a table, and Kip and I were sitting.
It's crazy,
so
isn't
we
it?
Did it, but we got to see them, you know? And so, you know, families make do, I guess.
Yeah, I think that we have a pretty good balance in our family. Whenever we have these family get-togethers for the holidays, it's really asking each other, how are you doing? Tell me about how things are in your life right now. It's not like someone initiates a conversation about physics and that dominates the time. No, that's not how it is.
Quite openly, does it help to have a grandfather, you know, being really skilled and knowledgeable about everything and be able to ask him, like, oh, can you teach me? Or I don't know how to understand this. Did you that?
When I was younger, it was extremely helpful to have someone to talk to whenever there was something that confused me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I wouldn't use it as a crutch. Like, he didn't do my homework for me, of course.
No. I'm not really suggesting that.
Yeah, but whenever there were topics that were a little bit confusing, or maybe when I was starting research with a new group as an undergraduate and I was trouble making like the big picture connections, it was really helpful to talk with him, you know, at a high level, mm-hmm. maybe not so much the details, what was going on and maybe what important things there were to know mm-hmm. in order to connect the dots myself. And so it was very nice like that.
I think that children have a lot of questions. To a certain age, children always ask questions like why, you know, the question why, you know, this, mm-hmm. that's the why this and why that, and it comes and it's tiring for every parent. And to some extent, some parents hate it because then as an adult, you don't have the answers, you don't know, and mm-hmm. you feel like you are losing the credit. And, you know, this aura of being father or mother who know everything.
Knowing all. Mm-hmm.
But I think that it does help to answer these questions. Mm-hmm. And that is very important. How can we motivate children to rest curious, even if we don't know how to answer some of their questions? Mm-hmm. Do you have any you know, suggestions for that?
I think you have to be a role model for being curious, you know, and being interested in anything and wondering and asking questions.
So even parents should ask questions,
yes,
right?
Yes, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, because, I mean, Kip doesn't know, you know, he knows.
He doesn't know everything?
He doesn't know everything.
Oh, really?
No.
Oh, what?
No, that's also
surprised.
Important, though. Yeah, right. Yeah. Not just being a role model and showing that you are curious, but also that you don't know everything. Mm-hmm. And I remember as a child, it was a shock to learn that my parents didn't know everything. Mm-hmm. Because
how shocking it was.
when my father stopped being able to help me with my math homework because I had gone beyond what he had learned.
And I stopped probably third grade. Of math.
Yeah.
But only because I think that I was curious, but then I needed more time mm-hmm. than I was given at school to understand things properly. Mm-hmm. I always had a feeling that I was not quick enough. And so after some time, I just decided that something else is more satisfying mm-hmm. for me. Mm-hmm. And I must say that when I looked and watched the interview of Brian Cox with Kip, I took a note that is the scientist must admit that they may be wrong mm-hmm. or that they don't know mm-hmm. and that what they think they know one day may be proved wrong.
Yes.
How do you work with that feeling that, you know, you feel that this must be right and this is it? And then there is a moment of slight hesitation. And after that, it only, you know, rises in you. And then you come to a moment when you say, okay, right, I was wrong. Mm-hmm. What then? How do you, like a human being, like a person, how do you fight with that ego telling you, oh, mm-hmm. I can't tell them I was wrong?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's the nature of science. I mean, you're always on the edge of discovery. And how do you know sort of what direction to go? Well, you go, you know, there's your gut, there's literature, there's, you know, what the field thinks. But there are plenty of examples in my field where, you know, we thought certain things or we jumped to conclusions too early. And so I'm always very cautious, and I teach my students this. You know, I emphasize those, you know, those counterintuitive findings that, you know, that fly against, you know, the common sort of thought about how things work. Because in my field, we don't know how things work. I mean, biology is such a complicated system. And we're trying to figure out how the brain works and how the brain recovers after a stroke. We know, you know, very, very little. Because we don't have a lot of theoretical foundations to go on. And so I expect to be wrong, but I search for those, you know, those counterintuitive findings to learn from and to say, ah, you know, I thought it operated this way, but in fact, it's completely different. Or we have to look at, you know, where the system is in terms of recovery, because it matters. The mechanism in the acute phase is very different from the mechanism in the chronic phase. We can't assume that it's the same thing. And so I guess that is how that sort of idea has penetrated the way I operate in my field. And I think it's a very important one. I have worked with colleagues who are adamant that their perspective is the right one. There's no other perspective. And, you know, if you're not with me, then, you know, you're not, you know, you're not in the game. And I think that's not the right way to approach, especially when you're sort of trying to discover things that, you know, could be completely different.
I think that people in general public, those who are listening to us, usually, and those, and many of those, or majority of those who are not listening, they don't like to be wrong. People don't like to be
wrong. No one does.
And what I'm trying to find out is the mechanism of learning people that being wrong is not the end of the game of everything. Mm-hmm. That being wrong only opens possibilities of being right the next time. And, you know, with COVID and this opposition of scientists and non-scientists and those who are fighting against science because they know better, I think that it's somehow making our societies, whole societies, really bleeding. It's really harming relationships. Mm-hmm. It's destroying families, mm-hmm. friendships, because mm-hmm. people fight over I am right mm-hmm. and you are wrong. Mm-hmm. What do you think about intuition? Is in science, when you need to see the proof, this is how it works. What is the, because in neuroscience, I understand that you are actually on the line between the physics and the body, you know, mm-hmm. the two worlds coming together. Mm-hmm. But in physics, how are you able to use or to feel, or is there anything, any force leading you towards like this is the way I should go if I want to prove something, I think it's right? Mm.
So in physics, we often throw around a phrase, you know, use your intuition. If you don't know where this is leading and where it might go, use your intuition. And what they mean by that is that you have been trained in the basics, in the fundamentals, and that should give you some sort of gut feeling. It should mm-hmm. guide your gut on where to go with that. And I think that's often a problem because sometimes people might doubt. So now we're coming back again to doubting mm-hmm. and to worrying about being wrong. They doubt that their grasp on the fundamentals, and then maybe they're a little bit more hesitant, or they take longer to develop the idea. And unfortunately, I see that a lot more in women. Hmm. I see that, this is just anecdotal evidence, of course, that I feel like my fellow female physicists are all a bit more reticent. They're reluctant to push forward and to take that intuition that they have and to go with it and to say, yes, I will proceed. And
why is that? Yeah. Why do you think is that?
That's a really good question. I don't have an answer for that, but that's just a pattern I've noticed. I think it must be related to confidence. It might be related to, you know, worrying that being wrong.
Only less than 30% of world scientists are female. Mm-hmm. In 2021, mm-hmm. it's a horrible number.
Yes.
I think less than 30%. It's almost nothing in 21st century.
But there are multiple reasons for that, right?
What do you think?
So, you know, the way the academic structure is set up, I mean, we're beginning to see this change, but, you know, women are discouraged from going into these careers where they can't raise a family at the same time.
I mean, that's a good point. That's a very good point.
And so they're choosing, you know, careers where they are supported. So they're maybe going into industry.
Yes.
Where, you know, they can take time off. There's maternity leave. And, you know, the expectations for, you know, tenure are, it's very different. Now, I think we see universities changing. You know, they're now, you know, they're giving paternity leave, you know, to husbands so that they can share some of the load of, you know, child rearing in the beginning. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's a change that's happening. That's a sociological change that's happening.
Quite late, right?
Yes, quite late.
Do you feel this is like a burden of or something, you know, you don't like? Because you were nodding, mm-hmm. you are young mm-hmm. at the beginning of your career. Is that something, you know, this working and life
balance.
Like balance, is it something you still feel as something present?
Yes, I think about it quite often, in fact. Trying to find a better work-life balance is one of the reasons. I tried moving my career from the U.S. to Europe because generally it seems like you have a bit of a better grasp on that. However, I'd like to come back again to this idea of raising a family because I've had a lot of female physicists that I've grown up with in my academic career over the years. And the idea of starting a family and somehow being able to still do the work that you want to do, to complete your PhD, to become a teacher, and all of these things, it becomes a really difficult point for everyone I've talked to who's wanted to start a family. They not only, when will I find the time to be able to have a child in graduate school? That's a huge problem. I know multiple people who have struggled with that. And the answer is there is no great time to do that. And that's really, really hard on people who really want a family and want to start that. And the second part of that is, all right, I have a child and that's good, but how will I be able to balance caring for my child while also doing physics at a level that people will respect me for? Mm. People to look at me and say, aha, you're only spending 50% of your time on your work. The other 50% is with your child. So we don't think you are serious. We don't think you're trying hard enough. You know, you need to give more time. And I think that's a really unfair expectation, even though it's unsaid. And what does this lead to? It leads to female physicist professors that you have as role models, so the ones that exist right now. For example, one of my advisors, she is a female. You look at her and you think, when does she have the time to do anything? She's raising two children, young children. She's in two collaborations. She has a husband. She's teaching. She's mentoring. And she's finding time on the side to do knitting and political activism. Mm-hmm. When does she find the time to be herself? And a lot of people look at that example and they say, I don't think I could do that. I admire her greatly, but I just don't think that I could withstand that pressure. And I think that's a turnoff for a lot of women when they think, what will I do after I get my degree? Do I want to be like that? It's very hard. I don't know if I want to do that. And so this is me just using the voice of a lot of women that I've encountered in the field.
It's not only in science. I realize that a lot of women in any other field where they want to succeed, it can be in politics, in art, in whatever, they feel like they need to be a superwoman.
Yes.
With absolutely fantastic talent for time management.
Yeah.
And still having a feeling, am I good enough? Am mm-hmm. I doing it right. well enough? Mm-hmm. And it's a constant pressure. So I understand that. I've went through that myself. And let me assure you, it can get better. Because I don't know what is your feeling and experience, Carolee, but when you get older, you just don't care. Mm-hmm. You just feel mm-hmm. that what is important is you mm-hmm. and your family. Mm-hmm. I understand that it's not easy in science when you are actually dependent on professorships and you know other people giving you credit for or inviting you to their teams. Mm-hmm. I appreciate and accept that fully. Mm-hmm. But maybe that's a question. I don't think that we will solve it here. But
of course not,
like
yeah.
what do you think would help? What do you think would really help if people would change in maybe in their attitudes? Because it's not going to help if I'm going to ask you to motivate young girls and children and maybe parents of girls just to support them in their curiosity and want to be successful in science. If all they can find in science is actually preventing them to continue on that
right.
field, what do
right.
you think would help?
Well, I think some of the changes that are happening, at least in the United States in universities, there's a real push to make sure women, so there's kind of a glass ceiling, you know, women make it to, you know, assistant professorship and then they don't get promoted. Or they make it to associate professor and they don't get promoted to professor, and or they don't get hired. And so there's a real push to make sure that the committees that are looking for new faculty are, you know, they have women who are in professorships on those committees, you know, because they have a network of colleagues. They know who's out there. They know who to look for. And so, you know, committee structure has to change. University leadership has to change. So the University of Southern California that's been in existence for probably 100 years now, I mean, that's young, it's old for the United States, has their first female president. Every president up to this point has been a male.
Well, Kamala Harris was...
Right, right.
She first, was...
Exactly.
Susana Taputo, our president, was the first...
Yes.
Female president in Central Europe, actually. So,
So they're going to be setting the agenda, and they're going to be establishing, I think, you know, ways of making sure women are at the table at all levels, and that's going to be then role models. And so, I think we're going to see change when, you know, that becomes sort of the norm, and you're not surprised when you walk into a room and there's, you know, half of them are women and half of them are men.
And you don't expect they will bring you coffee, right?
No, and you don't expect that they're going to be the ones, you know, taking notes and...
doing the easy job.
I mean, I have been in committee meetings where I'm the only woman, and comes time, you know, well, who's going to take notes? You know, and everybody looks at me.
Yeah.
Do you know that as well?
I mean,
it's a reminder of something in your experience?
I wouldn't say that it's so often happened to me. I've seen it happen occasionally, but I do actually have this implicit bias sometimes. I'll give you an example. I started out in this new collaboration when I was starting my PhD, and they were saying, okay, you need to give conference fees to this person and the secretary, and she will take care of things. And I was walking around, and there was one that was very helpful for me, this woman, and she was very helpful, and she made sure I got to the right people and made me feel settled. And I thought, wow, that was a really nice secretary. You know, she was very helpful. Turns out she was one of the group leaders of the research group. So I had this implicit bias that because she was doing these support tasks, that she couldn't be possibly be the person in charge.
So we have it.
We have
well.
It too.
Yeah.
We have it too.
Yeah. And it's really unfortunate. And that's something you that will also, as Carolee said, take time.
I have two final questions, maybe.
Yeah.
You working with human brain and, you know, everything. And I'm so sorry that we didn't have much time to talk properly about your work. Although I'm really sorry. I think that I would really struggle with
it. That's okay. It took me 12 years to learn.
Thank you. Thank you.
Don't worry.
Thank you.
Maybe next time you can at least try to explain to me. I do have some questions because I did take notes.
Good, wonderful.
Human brain. Mm. There is no difference between a female and male one.
There are differences.
Which one?
Yeah, well, I mean, this is not my field, but yeah. I am aware that there are differences in just the networks for processing certain things, global versus focal. There are differences in, you know, certainly hormone, which affects, you know, all kinds of function. But in terms of size and things like that, I mean, we are smaller in structure, but we have the same potential in terms of number of neurons and, you know, growth patterns
capacity.
And recovery patterns. Yeah. And
so what would possibly be the outcome if men and women would become equal and could contribute equally to everything we do, to science? If there would be 50-50 men and women, if you know, if women could really use their talents and everything they know and can, and they would, you know, there would be a full field open for them. Come join us and do what you want. And what do you think would happen?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I certainly don't have an answer to it. I have sort of a hypothesis. I think our world would be happier. I think that we would have less war, fewer wars. And that would not be the solution to, you know, to being able to live together. I just have that sense that women are less driven by power and more by wanting to gain consensus. Mm-hmm. Not to say that...
Isn't that a stereotype?
Yes, it is. And I was just going to say, not to say that there aren't men that are very skilled at gaining consensus. I think it's an art. But I think if you were to just sort of start from base, I think there might be a... I mean, I have a sister-in-law who studied play in children. Mm-hmm. And... you know, she saw different patterns of play. You know, the girls would try and, you know, get sort of consensus and play as a more of a team, and the guys would try to, you know, win. You know, who's gonna beat, you know, the other one. Mm-hmm. And these things are, and where do those come from? You know, they probably come from their upbringing and the role models that they see in their parents.
Role models, again, yeah.
So
very important.
It's probably more environment than it is, you know, inherent to our brain.
Yeah.
But we're social animals. Men and women are social animals. This is why COVID, I think, was so, you know, difficult for people, is that it made them have to be more in isolation. And there have been studies coming back to the brain of the brain doesn't do well in isolation because we are social animals. We have to have contact with other people. And I think that's sort of an inherent property of our species.
What it will cause, what it will do to us, you know, this experience of global trauma from isolation and fear and everything we don't know. Do you think it will influence human species?
I mean, we can look at the 1918, you know, experience. I mean, I think it took a long time to sort of equilibrate mm-hmm. around this. And you can go in many different paths, but I hope that people come together and realize that their behavior affects other people as well, and that they want other people to be okay.
They want each other to succeed. They want to bring everyone
yeah.
up. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that that's something I would comment is important about seeing a more equally, you know, male, female, distributed world. Mm-hmm. I think that what you would get out of that is that more people's needs are being met, right? I don't think that, you know, you should...
Yeah.
I'm a bit more conservative and cautious about my words. I would just say that, yeah, you would have more people being able to say, all right, we need this, and this is something that you have not provided us because you've always had, say, a male perspective.
I have three questions at the end of every podcast where I ask my woman sitting in front of me to tell me something very from her very deep herself. I will probably give you the two of you the same ones. Can a scientist have a spiritual life?
Absolutely. I think if they don't, they're not whole.
I think spiritualism can mean a lot of different things, and I'm glad you said spiritual. I don't particularly identify with any religion, but I think that I do see others benefiting strongly from embracing that. And, you know, I myself, I wonder at the universe, and I think that that's a kind of spiritualism itself, and it really does ground us all.
Mm-hmm.
keeps us curious, keeps us a bit more modest sometimes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, very important.
What would you be if you wouldn't be yourself?
Actually, I'm interested to see what you would say to this.
This is why I don't like the, you know, having you, because it's like, you know, cheating on, like, what are you reading?
No, I'm my own person. Yeah.
Good.
I'm just curious because I've never asked her this question.
Yeah. What would I be if I wasn't myself?
Well, maybe I'll stall a little bit for you. I would indulge the more artistic side of myself. I very much enjoy art. It's fun. I like the movement of dance. I like painting. I like making music. It's very much a part of me, just like physics is. I just happen to have chosen physics as a career rather than art. I kind of wanted to keep the art holy because it sort of kills a little bit of the enjoyment if you need to do the art to, you know, eat and pay the bills. But I would definitely become an artist, I think, if physics was not an option.
Yeah, you know, that spurred me because I've always thought, okay, when I retire, I'm going to take up something completely different. And I've been sort of thinking about what that would be. And art is definitely, it's in my grains. I mean, I grew up, you know, and I'm inspired by excellent art. I don't think I could ever become, mm-hmm. you know, a world-class modern painter.
But in your brain, you could be, right?
But in my brain, I could, yeah.
And maybe the last one really is, do you have any female role models? It doesn't have to be in science, but it can be. Mm. And it is just like someone, a woman, inspiring you a lot.
I have she was actually on my dissertation committee. Her name is Judy Smith. She was in my field, and then she went into, you know, administration and became dean of the music school at UCLA. And she's been sort of a role model.
Why?
Because she's been successful at many different things, because she is organized, she knows how to work with groups of people that, you know, maybe are in conflict with each other. Now, UCLA brought her out of retirement 3 times.
Because she must be someone
so good.
Good.
So she's a real role model.
Larissa?
I am having trouble coming up with an answer. And I don't know if that's maybe very telling that I'm having trouble to come up with an answer. I can think of many women who I've admired over the years for various reasons. You know, either that I admire their ability to be successful, or that I admire their ability to find happiness in life, you know, quite quickly and efficiently. And, you know, that's something that not a lot of people can do. Mm-hmm. But no single person jumps to mind.
But maybe it's good. Maybe it's good because it shows us that maybe there are women coming and more and more of them coming in many areas of our life who are becoming role models. And if they are not in solitude, maybe that's why you can't really see the only one.
It's a composite.
Mm-hmm. It's a composite. Mm-hmm. I thank you very much for coming again.
Thank you so much. Thank you for your great questions.
I thank you that I didn't
think.
It was really different than asking you about really specific things in your work. Mm-hmm. I very much wish you, so you become a role model for someone.
Yes.
That is
my plan. And I wish you would have time and space and a lot of happiness and emotions with the family. I really wish you good luck in science, but I think that family is also, if you really want it, it's very satisfactory. And I wish you a lot of success in your scientific endeavors with human brain, because that's something which really fascinates me. And I thank all of those ladies and gentlemen who were listening to us today.
Thank you.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Ďakujem, že ste počúvali môj podcast V ženskom rode. Ak vás tento rozhovor zaujal, vypočujte si aj tie ostatné. V ženskom rode môžete sledovať a zdieľať aj na Facebooku. Napíšte mi svoje názory, nápady a hodnotenie. Už o týždeň v stredu sa na vás teším s novým dielom.